This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to another episode of Infants on Thrones. My name is Tom Perry. In today's episode, I was joined with Bob.
Led Zeppelin was the first music I used to break the mission rules and listen to while on my mission.
And Bob and I were joined with singer, musician, and Wikipedia expert Ben Fellows. And Ben sits down with us to talk about his exit from Mormonism, his recent band The Lacuna Brotherhood, and their latest EP called Aftermath, and how the two are somewhat connected and how they're not really connected as well. And just as a quick disclaimer to those of you that like to listen to podcasts on high speed or double speed, I would highly recommend you to change your settings for this podcast down to normal speed, because there will be areas in this podcast where we will be playing sections of the songs on the latest album from the Lacuna Brotherhood. And if you are listening to it on high speed, you certainly won't be able to enjoy the music. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Well, so let's start at the beginning. So Ben, how you reached out to us, you'd reached out to us on Facebook, and you had mentioned that you'd put out kind of an album, or you'd put out several songs under a band name, and this all kind of came together pretty recently. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we wrapped up the project recently. It's actually been a project I've been working on for some time. The band is called The Lacuna Brotherhood. It's right now consists of me and our drummer, Dave Miller. And I've been in the studio off and on for the last year, kind of poking at this and recording these songs. And just last weekend, we released this first album. Well, it's actually an EP. It's only four songs on iTunes and Amazon MP3. And we got actually just verified today that we're in Shazam and Spotify. So we're pretty excited about it.
Nice. Cool. Got all the major digital outlets. Nice.
Yep. Right.
So talk about, I mean, you say you've been working on this for a while. How long has the Lacuna Brotherhood been in your mind, and how long has the process been from start to where you're at now?
Well, you know, I've been playing music for most of my life. I'm 35, and I picked up my first guitar when I was about 15 years old. So even though I feel like I'm still a young guy, I can say that I've been playing the guitar for 20 years, and it seems crazy to me. But, you know, this specific project, you know, really came together in the last year and a half, probably, and really started to take form after my divorce with my ex-wife and my exit from the church. And, you know, maybe part of it was I just needed a little bit of that angst and inspiration of going through something, you know, rough like that to give focus to my art. You know, because I've been playing music for a long time and I've been writing music for a long time. But after that happened, I suddenly just had so much material to work with. And I was, all of the songs that I were writing were getting better every time that I wrote one. And they had so much grit and so much emotion in them. And so yeah, that's kind of how it started. I jumped into the studio shortly after that because I felt like I had some really good stuff to work with. And for a long time, you know, I would schedule off an hour a week, maybe 2 hours a week to go in and lay down a few extra tracks. But then after a while, it kind of coalesced into this last few months. I was spending quite a lot of time in the studio, you know, whole big blocks of time over the weekends, and then going through all the mixing and all that kind of stuff. So it was a lot of work, but it turned out really well. I'm really pleased with it.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to the whole thing a couple of times. It's really nice. I also noticed that you have it just on your website streaming, which is cool. I guess you're using this other service called SoundCloud, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, so, SoundCloud is actually a pretty common platform for musicians. It's not as well known among non-musicians. It's been around for a while, but yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I think that the name of the band really is kind of an interesting play on some of the stuff that I went through, you know, as an ex-Mormon. For me, one of the biggest issues was the Book of Abraham issue. And I don't know if you noticed on the website, you know, our avatar is an Anubis head, right? That's kind of our logo, which to me, I think really kind of encapsulates a lot about, you know, if you could boil it down into one kind of symbol, that really encapsulates a lot for me about leaving the Mormon church, because it's like there was this papyrus, right? And there was this gap or this lacuna in this papyri. And Joseph Smith took this piece of, you know, real world truth, and he filled it in, he filled that lacuna in with something that was totally fake and completely random and weird and didn't fit at all with what this, you know, this thing was. And it turned into this whole, a whole book of scripture that was completely fake, right? And so the Anubis head is what should have been there. And that's what all of the Egyptologists that have looked at this papyri, you know, they all scoff and say, well, it's obvious that's Anubis who's standing there. He's just missing his head. And so the Anubis head for me is kind of this cool little symbol of that kind of exit from Mormonism.
You'd mentioned that the Book of Abraham was kind of the catalyst for a lot of things with your eventual decline or exit out of Mormonism. And you talked about some of the activity, how you got involved with the Wikipedia page and some of the behind the scenes there. Is there anything that you want to touch on with the behind the scenes stuff with the Wikipedia article?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I guess to back up a little bit, my first kind of taste of the quote unquote anti-Mormon literature, I hate that term, but, you know, for lack of a better term right now, was I ran into a copy of Von Brody's book, No Man Knows My History. And reading that book really kind of was an earth-shattering experience, because I read so many things in there that I had never heard before. And I grew up in the church, and I considered myself extremely well-versed in the doctrine and everything. But there were so many things in this book that I'd never heard before, and that really shocked me. And one of the biggest kind of earth-moving moments was reading about the Book of Abraham. And in Von Brody's book, I don't know if you, I'm sure you guys have read it, but it's kind of a passing reference. There's only a paragraph or two in the entire book that mentions it, but it's mentioned as almost this kind of, oh, it's just understood that this thing is a fraud and that Joseph Smith, I mean, it was like this foregone conclusion, and it just like blew my mind. And I immediately started researching on the internet and looking for more information about this. And I got a couple of other books. There's one called By His Own Hand Upon the Papyrus. And I actually started digging into the old, there's a journal called Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought.
Yeah.
An old journal. I don't know if it's still running. It probably is, but.
It's still running. What's the time frame here? Is this just like 4 or 5 years ago from now or what?
Yeah. So this would have been back in about 06 or 07.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did you graduate to Von Brody? Like, did you have the middle ground only approved sources and you found out about something that then made you make the leap into the deep end of the pool? Or did you just jump in with both feet, or did you wind up there accidentally? I'm just curious how you went straight for Von Brody.
Well, you know, it was almost kind of an accident, actually. I was in San Jose, California at the time, and I was actually looking for Bushman's book, The Rough Stone Rolling.
Right.
And I went to the library in San Jose and went to the, you know, the four book section of Mormon history. And there was the one copy of Joseph Smith's biography was No Man Knows My History. And I didn't know what it was. And I picked it up thinking, you know, at the time in my mind, I was thinking, you know, there are a few creeping doubts here and there, but I was, you know, the crusader that was going to go prove everybody wrong, just because I couldn't understand how the true church of God on the earth, I mean, this momentous thing, right, this concept, this is the one true church of God on the earth. Like, yeah. how can you fight against that? How can anybody who understands that fight against it? So I grabbed this book thinking, I'm going to do some serious research. I'm a smart guy. I'm going to prove all of the critics wrong. And of course, that was the first, you know, the first unpinning of the curtain, so to speak.
I love it. I mean, yeah. 50 points to Team Library. It's 2000, 2006, right. And like you go to the library and get the book that you know, by accident that wasn't the one you originally wanted instead of yeah. going to the internet. I mean, you didn't even have to resort to the evil that is the internet. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you'd mentioned real brief, Ben, that you believed. Because I think this is a usually kind of a standing trope where people that really invest in a lot and, you know, they're either becoming a seminary teacher, a gospel doctrine teacher, or whatever, and it's like they're researching just to become more educated in gospel doctrine or church history, and then that's when the shelf starts to fall apart. Would you say that that's pretty much where you fall in, where you felt like you really, you know, you were fully invested?
Yeah, absolutely. I was completely invested. I mean, the highest calling I ever got was like first counselor in the elders quorum. But I always saw myself as, you know, growing old in the church and being one of the church's biggest advocates. And in my modesty, I never would have admitted that I wanted to be a bishop, but I kind of did.
We've all been there.
Right.
Yeah.
And no, but I was completely committed. You know, I was an extremely obedient missionary, you know, to the point where, you know, our mission president tells us that we won't have the spirit if we're not home at 9:30 in our apartment. So I'm the missionary that's dragging my companion through the muddy, rainy streets of Guayaquil, sprinting at top speed, trying to get back to our apartment, because if we get there at 9:31, we won't have the spirit the next day.
Right.
So, but yeah, very committed, completely into the church. And you know, maybe that's one reason why it took me so long, I think, to get out of the church. It took me a really long time to really research and dig into it, because when this all started to kind of come down upon me, I remember sitting there thinking, this is the most important thing that I could be doing with my life at this moment, is understanding whether or not this actually is true or if it's a fraud, because people are telling me this is a fraud. And if it's a fraud, then I have to know. And it was a slow grind of furious research over the course of several years. And, you know, to bring it back to what you mentioned before, one of the tools that I had to really dig into the detail was the Wikipedia. And I don't remember how I first encountered the Wikipedia, but I remember having this moment where I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, the Wikipedia could have articles about Mormonism. I should check that out. And then I went on there and found a couple of, you know, articles. And the Wikipedia, for those who aren't really well familiar, has this core concept of trying to offer up perspectives that are neutral. So they call it a neutral point of view, or NPOV is a rule. They call it a rule on the Wikipedia. So there's this constant battle between Wikipedia editors who have one point of view against those who have another point of view. And they're always leveling this like stinging charge at each other that you don't have an NPOV. And once I got onto the Wikipedia and noticed that some of these articles weren't up to date, you know, based on all the research I was doing, I signed up to be an editor and started editing. And it became an obsession, quite frankly, for a good year. Every day after work, I would come home, I would log into the Wikipedia, and I would work on these Mormon-related articles and update them with the latest things that I had read, or check out references that people had put on there, you know, to try to see if they were actually true. And it was quite a fascinating time, actually, to be on the Wikipedia, because I don't think that you see this as much on the Wikipedia anymore. There was this moment in time where the Wikipedia was really growing really fast, and lots of content was pouring in. And at that moment, it was kind of Mormonism's moment, I think, in 2006, 2007, 2008, on the Wikipedia, where the topic of Mormonism is a little bit more obscure, so you weren't getting the high traffic editors on those pages, but the people who were invested in the idea of Mormonism, the ex-Mormons and the Mormons, were definitely on there, just throwing all kinds of stuff in there.
I remember when I think I was telling you this on the phone, Ben, that later in that time era, like 07, 08, 09, when I was doing my own research And I had taken a couple screenshots of the Mountain Metal Massacre Wikipedia article, and it was changing like every 24 hours. It could be several pages long to just being a paragraph long. I mean, I wasn't like you where I could see what was going on behind the scenes. I definitely didn't get into the editing portion of things, but I was frustrated because, you know, I was reading one thing and then I'd go back, you know, to my bookmarks and open up that browser page. I'm like, wait a minute, everything's freaking gone. What's happened?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty wild kind of rollicking time. And, you know, it actually some of those articles would change even faster than every day. It's like on an hourly basis, especially if it was a controversial topic and a controversial edit. And I remember staying up until 2 a.m. some nights, and people are still making edits to, you know, the Book of Abraham article or the Joseph Smith article or the Mormonism and Polygamy article. And I would just be sitting there just stunned. I was like, do these people ever go to bed? Because I want to go to bed. And they're still just making edits and splicing sentences and putting words and adding references. And yeah, so it's a pretty interesting time. And I tell you, it was quite a frustrating kind of battle at times, because there were definitely a lot of Mormon, very pro-Mormon editors that would get on there. And they would do that kind of stuff where they would blank whole sections of the page. And, you know, in the Wikipedia as an editor, you can get alerts on that kind of stuff. And, you know, first thing I would do, I'd come home from work, I'd log in and check my watch list to see what changes had been made and get angry. And then I would just, like, you know, in all my frustration, like, edit the Wikipedia and fix the stuff that they had broken. And there was a lot of people trying to whitewash, you know, the history that was on these articles. And, you know, for all of its faults, I think that's one thing about the Wikipedia that makes it really a great platform for information on the internet, is it's not quite a democracy, but it's kind of like it. As frustrating as it is for somebody like me who's an ex-Mormon to see a whitewashed version or the pro-Mormon line being advocated on a particular page, that tension between the two sides of the house gets you to, I think, a really neutral and quite accurate portrayal of events and, you know, the leading research on any given topic. So, I mean, if you go and read, you know, it's been a while since I've looked at some of these articles, but I remember, you know, about 6 months ago, you know, I went out on the Wikipedia just to see what some of these articles look like. And I went to the Joseph Smith Jr. page, which has kind of his quick summary of his biography. They actually split that page into like a whole series. And I remember reading it and just thinking, wow, every single sentence had a reference on it. And you go down to the bottom of the reference list and it's just like pages and pages of references to books and research and verifiable sources about what had actually happened in this guy's life. And I think that's really amazing to think about, you know, instead of, you know, the church or any other organization just saying, this is the way it was. You've got a collection of people that are verifying every single, they're parsing phrases and sentences in their nucleus and checking to see if it's actually accurate based on all the information that exists.
Wow. And so truth will prevail, as the saying goes.
I like to think so. Yeah. I mean, As an ex-Mormon who obviously has had his, you know, fingers deep into the internet and looking at the information that's out there, I do feel a pretty big sense of optimism for people that are looking for the truth about organizations like the Mormon Church. I have a really good friend of mine who's an ex-Jehovah's Witness, and we had an acquaintance that was an ex-Scientologist, and the three of us used to sit down and compare stories, and we all had that same kind of epiphany that this information is just right there at your fingertips on the internet, and that portends great things for humanity. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So do you feel like this is a success story for Wikipedia in the end, in the sense that it is a legitimate source or way to get that neutral point of view that, I mean, if you looked at the Book of Abraham page today, would you feel like it's still too tepid or lukewarm, and it's not really projecting or explaining what really is behind this, or do you feel like the model works and it's a reliable source of letting that truth out?
Well, that's a complicated question because the Wikipedia has its faults too, right? I don't think that the Wikipedia should ever be used as a primary source, but I do think it is, without question, the best place to start your research on any given topic because you can have a really good overview and it'll point you exactly in the right direction you need to go with your research. I'm the kind of guy who likes to read all the footnotes and verify everything that's being said. So when you look at the Wikipedia articles, the ones that are well referenced, you've got all the current research at your fingertips. You know, that having been said, the Wikipedia model only works well if you have a lot of editors. So the more obscure the topic, as the obscurity of the topic of the page goes up, the quality of the page goes down. And that's really apparent. I've seen pages about minor characters of the Book of Mormon. There are Mormons on the Wikipedia that are filling out a page, an article for every little person that existed in the Book of Mormon. And you look up one of those and it reads like a missionary tract. But I mean, who's going to actually go look that up and read it, right? And like, so, I mean, for me, I do think it is a success story for the Wikipedia, which I mean, you know, project that out. The Wikipedia is a microcosm for the internet as a whole, right? The internet is just a massive collection of information. And maybe the Wikipedia has a little bit more structure about verifying information that's being shared, but the internet as a whole is the same thing, right? You can post anything out there and for review and comment, and more information is always better than less.
Yeah, and that's why I'm wondering, I don't want to get too pedantic about it, but it just seems fascinating for such a hot topic like the Book of Abraham, because I don't know behind the scenes how the model works. If like 51% active Mormon editors versus 49% ex-Mormons, because there's only two type of people in the world. If that like changes the dynamic and it's that 1% that sways things, or if there's like some, you know, random atheist and Scientologist combined panel that's like weird in other ways that comes in the middle and like moderates. And I think like, I just think that there could be like a Saturday Night Live skit made about it or something, but I don't know what's really going on and how it actually, you know, all the duking it out happens.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think some of it is rather unstructured. The Wikipedia has a series of rules. Rules is probably a strong term. I mean, there are a certain number of concepts, like the neutral point of view concept. There's a whole list of these rules that you, good practice as a Wikipedian, you're supposed to adhere to. And generally speaking, if you adhere to those concepts and those rules, for lack of a better term, your arguments usually will win out. If you're just a random Mormon person and you log in and you just start tearing an article to pieces without trying to gain consensus, that's another precept on the Wikipedia's consensus building, then you're going to be shunned and people are going to be mad at you and they'll vote you down and things don't go your way. But as you kind of allude to, there are weaknesses in that, right? If you get a big cabal of Mormon editors that get on a page together and behind the scenes, they all kind of collaborate and like, hey, let's all get on this page together and we'll look like six different people from different parts of the world advocating for the same thing, then we can overtake, you know, a page. And that does happen sometimes.
Right. That's like serious collusion. Yeah.
Yeah. And that actually has been covered in the mainstream media on bigger topics than Mormonism. The Wikipedia has been the ground for propaganda pieces from governments and from companies that are trying to manage their image, like BP and the oil spill. I mean, some of these companies will hire, you know, marketing departments to manage their Wikipedia pages to make sure that they don't look bad. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, of course, again, I haven't been really plugged into the Wikipedia now for a few years, but that's kind of the way it was back in, you know, 07, 08 kind of time frame.
Well, then I have to ask though, are you unplugged because you threw your hands in the air and you're like, I can't, this is never ending and I can't win? Or was it like, period, I have the page is exactly how it should be. I'm going to step away. I'm sure it's neither of those, but I'm just curious what made you walk
Yeah,
away.
I think that after a certain period of time, things did kind of settle down, at least on the pages that I was concerned with. And so I wasn't spending as much time, but I think that m more to the point, it speaks more about my recovery process. Because to me, the Wikipedia was, it was catharsis and it was recovery, right? Instead of going and talking to a counselor, I was beating up people on the
It's cheaper.
Yeah.
Right. So it and I got to a point in my life, and this particularly became very apparent as I went through my divorce, because I was doing most of my Wikipedia editing about in the final year of my marriage. But as my marriage crumbled because of the Mormon issue, I was dealing with a lot of other things. And then I got on the other side of my divorce, and I just realized that I needed to step away from my own sanity. It was time for me to become just Ben Fellows the person, rather than Ben Fellows the ex-Mormon. And I still struggle with that sometimes. A lot of my friends and all of my family and a lot of people that I know, I suspect they think in their minds about me, and they think about me as the ex-Mormon guy. And it kind of bugs me because I'm a person, I'm a human being, just like everybody else,
Yeah, I've noticed that too, at least in my own life, where once you get that label, you spend like years trying to remove that label by breaking stereotypes, doing quote home teacher duties off the books, so you can prove to him like, hey man, I'm still a good guy. I mean, I'll come down and help you with your plumbing or electrical.
Right.
It's not a big deal. In fact, I was just down at my parents' today doing some plumbing stuff like that, and I kind of looked at my dad and said, see, you don't need home teachers, man. You got a disbelieving son. No, I didn't.
Right.
That's so good
Yeah,
of you
no.
guys. That's funny because I remember there was like a few months where I was like, I'm going to give 10% to a charity instead. And then, like, 6 weeks
Right.
into it, I'm like, fuck that.
10% is a lot of money.
That's a lot. Yeah. Holy crap. I can't believe I was doing that before.
Maybe 3%, just around the holidays, too.
Yeah, no, it's been interesting because, even today, I'll meet somebody at work and, we'll go out for a work lunch or something and they'll be like, oh yeah, where are you from? I'm like, oh, I'm from Utah. And where'd you go to school? I went to BYU. And you can see it in their eyes. Like if they're smart and they know a thing or two about the world around them, they're like, this guy's a Mormon. It always kind of bugged me that always came up, and to the point that I developed a case of Tourette syndrome at work, and I would just like curse like randomly just to get reaction out of people, just to like stake my, piss a circle around my desk so people know that I'm a heathen rather than a Mormon. I don't know.
Marking your territory.
That's right.
It's awesome.
Yeah, anyway, but yeah, it's but I feel a lot more comfortable in my skin now. Like I said, it's been quite a, well, I guess not quite a few years, but it's been a few years now, and I've got a little bit of distance now between me and, when I left the church and when my marriage, when I went through my divorce and things. I feel a lot more comfortable in my own skin,
So
and
then, do you hedge when you explain the inspiration for things? Like, I'm just thinking about back to your music, on your blog or your site, and just in general, the way you set it up was part of it is your exit from Mormonism influenced it. And but if I were in your shoes, based on this conversation, I would feel like wanting to say, but then there's this other part that has nothing to do with Mormonism. It's like only 30% ex-Mormon craziness. It's like 70% a deeper thing inside of me. Or I don't
Yeah.
know how you tell your story. I don't mean to make it silly, but that's how I would. I've had these mind games too when I like talk about passions and what's interesting to me in life and what my hobbies are. Nobody really cares, but you think that people care and like that you have to project where it's coming from and why it's only, a certain percentage ex-Mormon or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess well, there are a few questions there. So generally speaking, one thing that I found that after I left Mormonism, I became very, very open about my life. And all my friends and family say this about me now. They're like, if you get a beer in me, I will tell you everything that I've ever done. And maybe
the TMI filter comes off.
Absolutely. And I have this kind of, I'm kind of known for that. But I think that was partly a reaction to being in such a structured, robotic environment where you are not really allowed to say what you actually think about things. You know, if I had a doubt about the divine calling of Joseph Smith, I certainly couldn't say that to my family or friends, all of whom were Mormon, and I certainly couldn't say it in the church. And even to a certain extent, I couldn't say it to my friends at work, because I don't know if you know this, but accounting firms have a lot of Mormons in them, because BYU is unequivocally the best accounting school in the country.
I thought it was because Mormons were more trustworthy and honest than the rest of the population.
I have no idea.
No, I'm just kidding.
But you know, it's like you can't, like I felt like I couldn't really speak my mind, and maybe that's kind of developed in my personality ever since then. And I've often thought if I should try to be a little bit better about that, because I put my foot in my mouth quite a few times ever since then. But I do have a pretty conscious and serious commitment to living a very authentic life now, where what you see is what you get, and I will always speak the truth. You know, like it's like that little midget guy on Moulin Rouge. I always speak the truth. But you know what I mean? Like I don't want to live my life any other way where I am faking my way through anything or putting up a facade, because that's what I want you to think about who I am.
But wait a second. Like, you say that on the one hand, and I've seen myself saying things similarly, but then when you come on a podcast and talk to us versus when you go to a family dinner, you still put on different filters and you're still a different version of yourself based on the audience, right? Or
yeah,
are
yeah,
you saying...
Yeah.
Okay.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you can't always, you know, be completely unfiltered. Like you said, there are certain cases. You know, when I go back to hang out with my family, we're not talking about Mormonism, and but yeah, I mean, in as much as I can, that's what I like to be. That's who I want to project into the universe, you know.
I was hoping you would fight harder and be like, I drop F bombs at the dinner table. I bring up Fon Brody every time.
I went through a phase where I had this feeling like I was going to go and reach out to every one of my family members one by one, all 49 of my first cousins on my mother's side, and try to, you know, one by one, like, you should read this book. This is really important. And, but, you know, I got one or two deep in the list and realized that people don't want to hear that. And people only change when they're ready to change. And it's that way with anything, not just Mormonism, but it's the same way with politics. It's the same way with anything, really. And all you can do is lead by example, I guess, and be who you are. And people who resonate with you and who you are going to be attracted to you, and you're going to build a community of people that fulfill your life.
Well, I'm jealous that you only had to go one or two deep before you realized that, because I think I went at least a dozen before I started to realize, like, so you're not interested either. You don't want to talk about Mormonism either. I mean, I felt like I guess I'll just keep talking until I find the one that does.
Yeah. Well, you know, and
bridges,
maybe,
burning bridges all the way.
Yeah, maybe part of it was the Wikipedia experience too, because I had really lengthy arguments on the Wikipedia, and it's all there. I don't know if you know this, but on the Wikipedia articles, there's a little button at the top that says talk. You click on that. That is the talk page for the editors where they're discussing changes.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, wow.
And if you go to any one of those articles, like pick a controversial article, click talk, and you'll see people duking it out, arguing with each other, throwing spitballs at each other over whatever.
Is it under an alias, or have you like had knockout dragout fights with like named people within church organization?
So they're all aliases, right? They're all user IDs. And sometimes they're anonymous too. They're just IP addresses. But in recent years, I think you have to have an actual user registered user ID to edit Wikipedia. You used to didn't have to. Anybody could just jump on and change anything. But I have actually suspected that I was fighting against fairly prominent people in the church before, especially, I mean, I wish I could tell you which page this was on, but I think if I did, it would be really easy for somebody to figure out what my user ID was and trace back all of my edits. But, so you're going to have to be frustrated. That's all the information you're going to get out of me on that one.
The filter kicks in. I like it.
No, it's good.
Well, I mean, this is a little bit of self-preservation. I have had a few cases where I've been a little bit scared about the church looking over my shoulder. My user ID actually showed up in a Neil A. Maxwell Institute research paper about the Wikipedia and about truth on the internet. And
holy
so,
cow.
Yeah, so, and it showed up with a number of other user IDs of my friends on the Wikipedia that I had worked with. And so that was the only place that I saw it, but I know that people were watching my ID and the edits that I was making out there.
Wow. And what's the concern, if you don't mind me asking, that they could use that somehow to trace back to you and give you a hard time in real life, or you just don't like the idea of your anonymity being taken away from you because you might want to come back to Wikipedia? Or I'm just curious, like, what are the consequences that could lead to?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I think, I mean, maybe it is a little bit conspiracy theorist of me to be afraid of the church to actually sending their mob bosses out to knock me off something. But yeah, I think part of it is every once in a while, I still go on the Wikipedia and we'll make an edit or two here. I mean, in the heyday, I was doing hundreds of edits per day. And now, you know, it's like every 2 or 3 months, I'll jump on and do one edit. But yeah, I mean, I like the anonymity of being able to contribute good content. And I don't know, I guess I just, maybe it's just my feelies don't feel good. The idea of knowing who exactly I am.
Well, let me ask you.
I mean,
you
there's years of material of things that I've said on the Wikipedia about the church, and God, I can't even remember half of it. I'm sure I said some terrible things out there.
So, have you resigned? Is your name still on the record of the church, and does that matter to you at all, or is that not anything to do with this?
No, I did resign. Yeah.
Okay.
I had a philosophical issue with the church using one extra number in their statistics.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I have that same issue. It's just which issue prevails, the statistics thing where I don't like them miscounting, or the, like, my mom seeing the name not on her tithing settlement slip that her son is still potentially going to come back someday. I'm like, well, if it makes her feel better. So, like, I let the mom factor rule over the statistics factor, but that's this year. Who knows next year? That's kind of.
Yeah. You know, I didn't really think about that. I didn't realize that your name shows up on your parents' tithing slips.
Well, this is a rumor.
I'm sure she knows.
Yeah, this is from what I remember. You know, it's been so long, and it's not like I have this all documented like a Wikipedia page with references at the bottom or anything. But I know that it could just be a remnant of something I should research more, because I just know it was a big deal on my transition out of the church, that if I were to ever have my name removed, like, somehow it would really affect my family. And so I could be totally wrong. Maybe it's not as connected and obvious as I once thought.
Well, frankly, even if that was the case, I would have done it anyway. I, you know, after this whole discussion about living an authentic life, I was much more, committed to that idea right when I left the church than maybe I am now. But
sure.
And I, you know, I reached out to my parents proactively, and I told them, hey, you know what, I'm not part of the church anymore, just so you know. And I reached out to my brother and my sister, and before long, I'm sure the rumor mill was flying. So
right. And I guess I want to say too that I don't think it's fair to me, fair of me to like pin it on you that, you know, you can't live an authentic life and you still not have to be different people in different circumstances. I think there's something to be said about authenticity and conflict awareness. They're not mutually exclusive. Just because you're authentic right. doesn't mean you have to go pick a fight with everybody from your past.
Right. Right. Well, and it's not for everybody, right? I mean, for every person might feel completely authentic and at home with himself without having to do something like resign from the church. For me, that was a big deal. So that's something that I decided to do.
Yeah, good for you, man. Yeah. Well, let's. Can I go a little music nerd on you?
Yeah, sure.
Kind of transition away from the Mormon bullshit.
Absolutely.
Nice transition.
There's no Randy here, so I'll take it. I'm a big music nut, and when you'd sent the link to your album and your website and stuff like that, I started streaming it and listening to it immediately. And then when I talked to you on the phone the other day, I asked you, what did your band consist of? And like you said at the top of this podcast, that it's essentially you with a hired out drummer. And I do know that, you know, technology has allowed musicians to do a lot of their own work where they can save each track and then overlap it. So essentially they can create a song all on their own if they have the skill set. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, just a point, a quick point. So I hired Dave to do the drum work. And in the last couple of months, he decided to actually join the band. So even though technically he was a session musician for the actual recording, we're moving forward together as a band, looking the brotherhood.
So yeah, he was hired. Now he's promoted.
Right. So, but yeah, you know, that's partly modern technology. I think people have been able to do that for a long time. But you know, when I went into the studio in the beginning, I just took my acoustic guitar, and I laid down the acoustic guitar track, and then overdubbed the lead vocal on each of those four songs, and that's all it was just this raw acoustic and this raw vocal track. And then over time, I would come in, I would lay down the bass line, I'd come in and do the electric guitar, you know, and then at one point we got enough going on that we really needed the drums in there to fill it out. So that's when I hired Dave to come in, and hired him for a whole day on a Saturday, and for 8 hours he just sat in the studio and we did about two or three drum tracks on each of those four songs to hammer that out. And then, you know, just adding pieces and parts organically over time. And then in the last few months, I've been focusing on mixing, so making sure that between the different tracks the volume levels are right, adding some subtle effects here and there, and kind of honing it into what you want it to sound like.
That's crazy. I mean, I assume you're like using a computer or Pro Tools or something like that, or do you have like a studio at your disposal?
Oh yeah, I went into a studio. There's a studio in Littleton, Colorado. It's a Spin and Swirl Studios.
Oh right.
And
okay, cool.
I went in there, and I paid the studio time every time I went in there. I thought about doing some of the studio work myself, and I experimented with some stuff. But at the end of the day, I mean, I'm a pretty smart guy, and I probably could have figured it out. But I would rather spend my time on the creative process than the engineering. And so it was worth it to me to just hire out the engineering. So, yeah, so I paid for all the time at the studio. Just a quick shout out, Sean Palmer and Mike Alundi at Spin and Swirl, fantastic guys. Really great years for music there. And, you know, I spent many hours with Micah in the studio doing the mixing, and he would hear just, you know, the subtlest things like, why don't you try that? And put a different kind of distortion effect on the guitar, or add an echo here or a reverb there. Or, you know, it was a great, really fun process building all this music.
So what are your influences, and when you picked up the guitar when you were 15, what's the story behind that? What were you into, and where did it go?
Wait. Hang on a second. Kind of elaborate on that question, because I kind of put this little list together, and before you answer like your influences and stuff like that, I want to ask you a few pop quiz questions to maybe help narrow it down, and then you can elaborate as we go.
Pop quiz, okay.
Me and Glenn did this early on, and I thought it would be fun. So, right. So Ben, Beatles or Rolling Stones?
Beatles, definitely.
Alice in Chains or Soundgarden?
Oh, God, Alice in Chains, 100%.
Really? Okay.
I am a child of the grunge movement, and I love both of those bands. But Alice
you
in
dismiss
Chains
Soundgarden so easy, though.
That's because Alice in Chains is my favorite band on the earth. I love
is
that
it?
Band. Yeah, have you heard their new album?
Yeah, I own it. The Dinosaurs Walk the Earth.
Devil Put Dinosaurs Here. It's great.
It's so good. So good.
Yeah.
Okay. Nine Inch Nails or Muse?
Muse.
Yes.
Oh, man. Nice. I totally thought I had Bob on that one.
I went to a Muse concert this last summer. It was incredible. And their last album, actually, The Second Law, they do some really wild stuff on that album. There's this song called maybe it's Isolated System or something like that, and he's using a whammy pedal with his electric guitar in this crazy way. It makes it sound like dubstep, and it's just, I think it's just brilliant, guys.
Doesn't somebody on Muse have like that touchscreen guitar
bullshit? Matt Bellamy, the frontman.
Yeah, I think they're doing some really. I am also a huge music nut, and I just love and crave new sounds. And I'll listen to music, and if I hear something I've never heard before, I can't identify what that sound is. I'll make a note of it, and I have to go look it up and figure out how they made this sound on this record.
I thought for sure you'd give Trent Reznor a little more leeway there, you know, because you follow in his footsteps by doing so much solo. I was like, man, maybe Reznor's on his influences, but I guess not. Muse takes the lead.
You got it black and white.
I do greatly enjoy Nine Inch Nails. So I'm picking one over the other doesn't mean I think the other one's shit. I'm just
All right, Metallica or AC/DC?
Metallica.
Yes. Good choice. So guitars, acoustic or electric?
Oh, that's such
a hard... What kind of question is that?
These are all bullshit
do you like...
questions. Come on, man.
Do you like
join
protein?
In, Bob.
Do you like protein or carbs? Like,
I'll say this. At its core, my music is all based on acoustic guitar, which I'm not sure if you can tell, especially in Taboo. If you listen to that song, it starts out with an acoustic riff, and it's kind of affected. It's got some echo and reverb and some weird effects on it, but that's the foundation of the entire song, even though it turns into a pretty grungy Nirvana-sounding kind of a song. You know, I really love acoustic guitar, especially some of the really cool stuff that's come out in recent years, like Andy McKee. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Look him up on YouTube. He's got like 50 million hits on YouTube, and he does this amazing slapping and harmonic stuff on his acoustic guitar. I just think that stuff's completely brilliant. But, you know, I really, really dig Avenged Sevenfold and just like really heavy, gritty electric guitars. I guess at the end of the day, I'm a rocker. So I don't know, I'm going to have to say I can't decide. You both get a point.
Nicely done.
I was just curious because I thought, you know, that cliched question, what are your influences? Because, you know, I listen to several music podcasts and whatever. And when I hear this, I often think, oh, everybody talks about the Beatles and Rolling Stones and all that stuff. And I imagine that all those bands had an influence on you personally. But I guess what went into the inspiration on this particular album? Because it does seem like you go a little philosophical, like Solitary Man, that song. I know that's my personal favorite of the four that you've got. It's just very smooth. It's very melancholy, and I love the harmony. That's when I asked you on the phone if you had a backup vocal guy, and that's when you told me, "No, man, that's freaking me, dude."
Yes. Solitary Man is definitely, well, it's obviously the mellowish, you know, really sad and depressing ballad on the record. But and you know, maybe that's a really great example of the juxtaposition of my love for acoustic guitar versus some of the grungier stuff. But I love really bare songs like that are exposed. And, you know, I had actually in my mind constructed a more upbeat, more full band produced version of that song. But especially after we laid down the tracks for that song, it just sounded so good with just a harmony, a lead vocal, and an acoustic guitar that we just had to stick with that, you know. And we just filled in a couple of subtle things here and there, like a shaker. You know, there's an egg shaker in there. You can hear it. And then Dave Miller does the tabla drums, these Indian drums that are really subtle. And it turned out really, really well.
Emphasize the guitar solo. There's a lot of bands that are dropping the old guitar solo. You know, it's like really, really shine the spotlight on that moment, you know, just let it rip. And I love that stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a vintage James Hetfield, isn't it? Right. You get your verse, chorus, solo, verse, chorus.
Right? Yeah. Right.
No, but I always loved listening to guitar solos, and I'm not like a crazy shredder like some of these people are, but
not yet, right?
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence. But I do try to make them sound interesting melodically. And I think that you know, I'm really happy with the way that they turned out. You know, the guitar solo on Not My Enemy in particular was a total blast because what we did with that is I laid down the electric guitar. And I had this wah-wah on it, and it, I had this tremolo effect too. And then after we laid that track down, I was working with Sean in the studio at the time. He's like, well, should we do another one? And I said, okay, yeah, let's do another one to see if we can get it better. And we laid that one down. And then he's like, just, you know, bear with me for a second. I'm going to try something. And he put the one solo in one channel on the left and the other solo on the other channel on the right at the same time. And it was just amazing sounding. And that's what's in the song, is you've got two guitar solos that are almost exactly the same, but not quite. And so you can almost kind of hear them competing with each other if you listen really close. And I tried to make it sound really kind of wild and weird with a lot of bent notes. I mean, every note on that solo, I'm bending it almost a half step or a full step up and then down again. And so it just sounds like this weird, like a lilting kind of limping thing that's walking up these steps to its death or something like that. I don't know. Sets me free. Pain is the key. The pain helps me see, and the pain is not my enemy. No, the pain.
To ask the question, Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd?
Oh, Led Zeppelin all the way, man. I love Zeppelin.
Okay.
You're hitting on all my favorite bands here. Like Led Zeppelin, oh, this is kind of a funny story. I remember laying in my bunk at the MTC in Provo the first week of my mission, and I was like, I'm going to forget all the Led Zeppelin songs. And so I would go through my mind, like reciting all of the lyrics to every Led Zeppelin song I could remember. I absolutely adored that band. It was the best.
That's awesome. Led Zeppelin was the first music I used to break the mission rules and listen to while on my mission. So that has a special place in my...
Whoa, TMI, Bob.
What?
Jeez,
wow.
You're breaking the rules on your mission. I kid.
Yeah. It's like right up there with masturbation. I listen to Led Zeppelin. Oh, no.
Just don't do them at the same time.
No.
Wait, are you saying you masturbated when you were on your mission?
No, my friend did. He told me about it.
The guy in the mirror.
Yeah, you know, I actually, you may not believe this, but I didn't masturbate the entire 2 years I was on my mission.
Wait a second. Are you the guy? Did we have this conversation in one of these Facebook chat rooms where I need to keep track of who I'm like telling things to? Because there was somebody who was like, yeah, I didn't do it for my whole mission. And then like me and 20 other people are like, bullshit. It was just like 17 more comments trying to disprove that that's even possible for a male that's 19 years old without a problem.
That was not me, but it is true. I buckled down and I was a good boy, and it was really tough.
So the entire 2 years.
The entire 2 years, and it lasted. And I got home from my mission, and lasted about a month, and then it was all.
It was over.
There's been every day since.
I'm just taking you at your word, but you should have got a damned award for that then.
I know.
Yeah.
Did you get did you trade it in for zone leader or AP or something? Was there a direct correlation that you were using in your mind? No.
No. I never made zone leader or AP, but I, like I said, you know, I was totally committed to this, to the church, and you know, I'm not saying it wasn't hard, but I was completely committed. I was a stickler for the rules, so not saying I didn't have many a wet dream, but.
Yeah, that two years was very hard.
Used to lay in bed hoping I would have a wet dream.
Lay a bed awake, you're like, how does this work?
Well, my art has been something that has always been kind of my way to cope with, you know, the struggles that I have in my life. And I've ever since I picked up the guitar, I've been writing music, and I started playing bass guitar in a jazz band in high school. And shortly after that, I started a rock band. And then after I went on my mission, I just really just kind of, it was a very personal thing. And I used to just sit at home and play a little bit every day. And the last year it's been really great to see this stuff come full circle and to full fruition and be able to share it in a way that's meaningful to other people. And I already have a backlog of about 20 songs, and the next album is already planned. So,
nice.
No kidding. So, yeah, so you're going to do a full-on, like, 10, 13-song album?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And I'm really excited, too, because I feel like not to bag on the stuff on this album. I really am proud of what we've created, but I'm really excited for the next album, because some of the newer songs, I think, are really show a development in my songwriting, and I think are much better. So,
do you have like a timeline that you guys are aiming for, like in 2015 maybe, or this year?
I would like to get it done before the end of the year, but I don't know. We're gonna have to see, because I think over the course of the spring and the summer, we're gonna try to play a few shows in the Intermountain region, and we're likely gonna make it out to Salt Lake at least for one or two shows, and then. Yeah. After that, we will head back to the studio. So
nice. So to tie it up with a bow, if you don't mind, I was curious. I don't think you ever got a chance to answer the question on how much of this is you, the ex-Mormon, or versus you, the musician, independent of the ex-Mormon, and if that's just transitioning more and more towards leaving Mormonism completely behind as you go into the new album. But this one has a lot of that, or if you have something to say there.
Yeah, sure. So Taboo is definitely about my exit from the church in a lot of ways. Tsunami is in a great deal influenced with my experience with my divorce, and just kind of the overwhelming feeling of not knowing what you're going to do with your life and what's, you know, washing over you in that moment. Solitary Man is a fairly recent song. I wrote that one last year, well after my divorce and well after leaving the church, and that's more of a breakup song with my ex, about my ex-girlfriend. And my art is definitely moving in the direction of leaving the Mormon church behind, because you get a few years of life under you, and there's more interesting things, more bad things and more good things that happen to you and have gotten on with my life, and my music and my art is starting to reflect that. This record, I guess if you're saying percent wise, I don't know, it's probably 50-60% kind of influenced by that whole journey out of Mormonism and out of my marriage. But all of my newer songs are much more in tune with, experiences that I'm having more on a daily basis. The world and the universe is just such a fascinating place. Like, I'm constantly stunned when I look around me and look at life and the stars in the sky and the trees and all their little leaves and veins in their leaves. And like, it's just amazing, this universe that we're in, this phenomenon of life on this planet. And then, to be able to connect with other people in a romantic way or not a romantic way, just experiencing their experiences and understanding who they are and the things that they've gone through. There's so many things about life on this planet that are fodder for exploration and, re-expression through art, and be it through music or through movies or visual art or whatever. And I'm just completely fascinated that this entire creative process and the life that I'm living now, Mormonism is part of my story and it's part of who I am, and it's part of my past. But as it grows fainter in the distance, it will be less and less part of my art as I explore other parts of my life and the universe around me.
Excellent. That was incredible. Sheesh, it's like you're you know what you're doing. You know what you're saying. I love that.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I do feel like that sometimes.
Well, Ben, I think this is the best place and the best time to end it right here. And we'll definitely be putting the show, you know, in the show notes. We'll have links to your website and your songs where they can go and purchase it on iTunes or on Amazon. And definitely we'll be following you. And it, yeah, man, if you make it to Salt Lake, dude, I'll definitely have to make it up there to watch you guys live. And that'd be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I really appreciate it. It's been great to be on the show. And I look forward to it.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
You've been listening to If and Stand Throws.
Say, please subscribe to us. On iTunes.
And give us feedback.
We like five stars.
And go to Infants on Thrones.
InfantsOnThrones.
Yes!
.com. And that's our website.
Please invite us, because this is me and Daddy speaking. Please listen to us. Goodbye.